he and his family benefit from people dying. No way to get around it. If my family dies, they want to get the body. If your family dies, they want to get the body. In fact, they require you to die in order to get the new red sports car for their daughter. You understand, the young daughter. They require you to die to pay the mortgage, to send the children to school, to have all the nice things that they require you to die. Right? Now, I truly, this is a nice man. You three people might know who I'm talking. It's a really nice man. I love this man, etc. But not enough to accommodate him being able to live well. You understand? If it comes to it, if the people in this community had a choice of him living well and the rest of us living long, generally speaking, we would say, I'm sorry, you understand? I'm sorry, but you will not pay your mortgage today, you understand? not from these bodies, right? That's how we would say it, right? Because we have an understanding that we have a distinctly different material interest. I like this man. I like his family, etc. But I ain't dying for you. You understand? I am not going to die. It doesn't matter how much you sing nice, our families went to the same church, right? But I understand that we have different material interests. Do you say what I'm saying? Now, if this man, brothers and sisters and comrades, welcome to Africa Live. This is Amale Shitela, chairman of the African Socialist International. I'm sitting in today for Comrade Nyabinga Zimbabwe. This is his show, but he's on our disabled list for the moment. He's been out with an injury. On today, I should let you know that the show you're listening to was pre-recorded. This pre-recording is happening on Friday afternoon, and by the time you will be listening to this, the events that we're going to be discussing about what's happening in the world will have escalated to a point that we may not have foreseen at this time, because clearly there are serious struggles unfolding in various places in the world. And at this moment, they appear to be escalating. Nevertheless, I think that it is incumbent on us to begin this discussion now. And the basic content of this discussion will continue to be relevant regardless of the direction and intensity or the intensification of some of the issues that we're going to be discussing. In this discussion with us today, Vanessa Thompson, who right now is in Berlin, Germany, she is a German-born African woman, young woman, who is actively engaged in the political work of our movement. There is Comrade Luwesi Kinshasa, who is the Secretary General of the African Socialist International. He will be speaking to us from London in the United Kingdom, as it's called. And Penny Hess, who is the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee, who is based in the United States. The three persons who will be involved in this discussion with us on today are all members of the Uhuru movement, are all under the leadership and discipline of the African Socialist International and the various African People Socialist Parties that exists in the locations from which they are speaking and where they do the work. I wanted to make that known because the reality is that the things that we want to talk about, the events occurring in the world, are seen by us through the lenses of African internationalism, which is a particular worldview that is informed by our understanding of how the world that we are engaged with and in today came into being in terms of its economic and political and even its social structure. And based on the economic foundation, economic structure, even many of the ideas that impact and influence peoples around the world. In fact, most of the ideas and legal systems and everything that we want to talk about from our point of view as African internationalists have their origin, their basis in this superstructure, economic superstructure that we define as parasitic, a parasitic capitalist superstructure that was born of the theft of resources, lives, countries, sovereignty of Africans and other peoples around the world. And I'm saying that this is important to state this because when you engage in other kinds of discussions and from radio and TV and other mediums, they don't necessarily express, quite frankly, that they are speaking from a particular worldview. And most people make the erroneous assumption that there is no such thing as a truth, a reality that responds to the interests of various sectors of society. We don't make that error, and we are quite frank in telling you that our views are influenced by how we understand this whole world is structured and the relationships that Africans and other oppressed people have in this world. Excuse me. On the anniversary of September 11th, 2001, this would be the 11th anniversary we're talking about, we saw the beginning of a series of uprisings and that were directed primarily at the United States, at its the symbols of its presence in various countries, primarily the embassies and the diplomatic quarters areas in various places in North Africa and other places in the Muslim world. We have also seen some of this discontent, protest directed most recently at Germany. And I think that some of it may have been recently directed at England from the various countries. We have seen these uprisings, which began, I think, on the 11th in Egypt, with demonstrations at the United States embassies in Egypt, spread quickly to Libya, where this man, who Christopher Stevens, who was recognized as the ambassador to Libya from the United States, along with three other persons who are from the United States and who were presumably a part of the diplomatic corps, killed. Rapidly, we've seen these demonstrations, which have included attacks on U.S. embassies and burning of Obama, U.S. President Barack Hussein Obama's effigy, the burning and trampling of U.S. flags, massive mobilizations demanding the U.S. leave places such as Iraq and Afghanistan. These demonstrations have gone to Yemen, as I said, in Egypt, Tunisia, Sudan, where both England, English and German symbols have been come under assault, making it necessary for police there to fire weapons into the air. In Afghanistan, the, as I mentioned, effigy of Obama was burned. In Bangladesh and Qatar and Kuwait, Malaysia, Nigeria, Kashmir, Lebanon. These are just some of the places where we have seen these expressions of outrage at the United States and increasingly at other imperial entities such as I mentioned, England and Germany. Some people have assumed that the explanations given as for why this is happening can be accepted at face value. We are told that the demonstrations, the protests, are a response to a video that was done that insulted the Prophet Muhammad, who obviously is very dear to Muslims all around the world. But I think that that's not the best explanation we can come up with, although I'm sure that people are rightfully upset at an attack on the Prophet Muhammad. We've seen the U.S. military forces, for example, in Afghanistan, go so far as to burn the Quran, which is the religious, it would be, it's the equivalent of the Christian Bible, and that has resulted in uproar. We've seen uproar caused by a preacher in Gainesville, Florida, who has made public attacks on Islam and Muslims. But I think that what we are looking at is a response by people all around the world who have suffered from imperial conquests and who have come to understand almost instinctively in some instances that the attack on Islam is not some innocent exercise of free speech by white people in America and various places of Europe who have this really sanctimonious and hypocritical defense of freedom of speech. Rather, I think that what is being understood by most people, at least instinctively, in these areas, most oppressed people, that what we are seeing now is an attack on the belief system of oppressed people, which has always gone hand in glove with the actual imperial conquest. In fact, it has been almost necessary to make an assault on the belief system of peoples as a part of the effort to conquer people and to bring them under some kind of subjugation or submission. And I think it would also be important for us to understand that the hypocrisy in this whole question of this being this notion of defense of freedom of speech and how this is so irrational what the Muslims are doing, when the fact is in Germany, in France, perhaps even in England, people can go to prison, can go to jail for actually suggesting that what the Jews and the imperialists have said happened in the Holocaust really did happen. It is actually a jailable offense in much of Europe to deny that the details and much of what has been defined as the Jewish Holocaust actually happened. So that's so much for free speech. And the reality is in this country, in the United States and in England, even recently, especially in England, we've read of homes being raided, people being arrested because of an assumption that they have anti-American or anti-British ideas or attitudes, etc. So it is hypocritical to talk about this being something about free speech. That is clear. But I think also it's worth understanding something about the recent developments in what we call the Middle East, and that would include the fact that last year, I think that this what we saw heightened in December, but I think as early as November, we saw this unfolding of what has come to be characterized as the Arab Spring. And the thing that makes this important is that the power, the authority of the United States and the imperialist world has been concentrated, or have been concentrated, in the arrangements that saw the illegitimate white nationalist settler state of Israel as being the chief police entity defending the imperialist interest in what they characterize as the Middle East. And that it is a nuclear-armed entity that has been dropped down in the middle of Islamic and Arab countries for the exact purpose, again, of protecting the interests of imperialism and at the expense of the Arab and North African people. It is an entity that has been armed to the teeth by the U.S. in particular, that has expended its highest amount of military resources directly and specifically for that purpose, giving it the most sophisticated military technology. It has been backed up by reactionary Arab regimes, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the Arab United Arab Emirate, and a host of others. That included Tunisia, and most recently, for a while, it included Yemen. It has been backed up by the Fifth Fleet that was placed in Bahrain precisely for the purpose. I mean, this was the reason that the Fifth Fleet was created and placed there, was to protect these interests that we're talking about, with Israel being the linchpin to the whole thing, especially since the Iranian overthrow of the Shah of Iran, who was another a part of the police organization, imperialist police organization, this time in the Persian Gulf. When the Egyptian, the Tunisia happened, that was serious. But when Egypt, the Mubarak, came on the fierce assault by the masses of people in Egypt, that represented a really strategic problem that they had, partially because of the size and influence of Egypt, partially because this is another place where the U.S. government had placed a lot of resources, money, invested it in the military, much of which it has trained and even leads in some ways up to now. It is has been with Egypt that much of the strategic relationship protecting Israel has been invested. And so when the so-called Arab Spring that caught the imperialists completely off guard, and I know that there are some who say would think that maybe the U.S. or somebody planned the Arab Spring. They didn't plan it. It caught them completely off guard, which is why there was silence from the White House for the first several days when this developed, because they were trying to see how this was going to unfold, because the removal of Egypt actually laid bare, or almost bare, the illegitimate white nationalist state of Israel. And but the other really most important thing that it did was it contributed to a really change in the balance of forces, the balance of power in that region. Now, with Egypt trouble and the possibility of masses and coming to power there, we had a situation where Iran, Syria, Libya took on much greater significance to the imperialists because, and also Hezbollah in Lebanon, because it meant that these were forces now that would achieve much greater significance in this balance, and that these were all hardliners as it relates to the illegitimate white nationalist state of Israel. And it meant that the shifting in of power, of force that they found seriously threatening, which is what led the U.S. To participate in this French-initiated assault on Gaddafi and Libya that led to his lynching in the streets of Libya, which is what led the U.S. to attempt in its escalation of war and threats against Iran to make the same thing happen in Iran that they had done in Libya, except the Iranians were able to crush it almost immediately, and which has led the imperialists to move similarly in Syria to destabilize that regime and to move toward overthrowing it and replacing it with some puppet more amenable to the interests of imperialism to maintain the status quo or the balance of power in that region. And they actually gently nudged Mubarak out of power in order to protect the relationship that it had with the military, with the generals. If people can remember, initially when the uprisings began in Egypt, the people were declaring that it was the police that was the enemy, but the military was their friend, not necessarily recognizing that the state, the military, is simply an extension of the state apparatus itself that's there for protecting the status quo. And so there was a talk immediately about initially about if the generals in Mubarak were gone, this would lead to the Muslim Brotherhood possibly coming to power. If you remember that this stalled and frustrated the process that was supposed to lead to elections temporarily. Actually, it was declared that the Muslim Brotherhood could not run for office. And then finally, there seemed to have come to some agreement that allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to participate. in the elections. And clearly what developed was some kind of agreement, obviously influenced by the United States, that had to do with influencing the military and the Muslim Brotherhood into a relationship that would protect the status quo without Mubarak. So there was an assumption that with the assassination, the murder of Gaddafi, with the placing the military and the Muslim Brotherhood in power in Egypt, with crushing the uprisings that had begun in Bahrain, this was crushed, of course, with by Saudi Arabia, which is the real authority in that area. There were with pushing hard against Iran, the ongoing threat of military intervention against Iran, there was the assumption that they had stabilized the situation sufficiently to give them some breathing space, that they could return that area into something that could still rescue the interest of imperialism in the United States in particular. And so what we just saw happen on September 11th, 2012, is the unraveling of the best laid plans of the imperialists. That it has become clear, it seems to us, that what they assumed to be the reality was not the reality at all, and that they do not control the events as they thought they controlled the events. And so we have this real escalation of dissent, uprising, growing militancy in opposition to the people. And even as this occurs, we have the situation in South Africa following the Lonmin mines massacre of more than 30 miners and their inability to suppress that, the deals that they thought they were going to be able to make, the attempts they made to try to intimidate the miners, that has resulted in an intensification of the resistance there in South Africa, which is another really important partner to the whole imperialist order as they are attempting to construct it. These really important factors, and then I think we have to factor in the reality that as they are trying to do this, the kinds of things happening throughout Europe, ongoing struggles by people in Spain and France and Italy, in Greece in particular, that's the need for the most of the European governments now to begin cutting social services and pushing back and transferring primarily this imperialist crisis onto the backs of Europeans who are not accustomed to this at all. In the United States just recently, we had this so-called quantitative easing, which is placed the United States, the Federal Reserve, in this position of buying something like $40 billion of U.S. bonds per month. With no end in sight. So there's a kind of cannibalization that we're looking at of in happening with Europe and the United States, which is extraordinary. So I just wanted to have this discussion. I think that with the people in this panel, that we ought to be able to have a good discussion. I wanted to talk to and get a sense of how we understand this, and there are some things that I probably mentioned that can be elaborated on. In addition to that, I think it would be important for us to get a sense of how people and institutions in Europe, in Germany, like how do we have any evidence of how and whether the people are talking about this at all and how they're experiencing this? Do we have any evidence in the United Kingdom or any place else in Europe about the economic implications of any of this? Do we see any signs or signals? You know, like, what does all of this mean? And then what does any of this mean in terms of advancing prospects for real transformation that will lead to the people coming to power over their own lives as a consequence of the defeat of imperialism? So right now, this is, again, Africa Live. And I am Omali Ishitela, sitting in for Nyabinga, Zimbabwe. And we won't be having call-ins today because this is being pre-taped. This is a pre-taped show. It's being taped on Friday, because, and we may say some things here that by Sunday, when you, as you are listening to this, may be old news, and in fact, many changes may have transpired by that time. And with me in the studio, again, is Penny Hess, the chairwoman of the African People Solidarity Committee, a North American or white woman, who whose work is primarily focused on organizing in white communities here in North America, and increasingly moving toward such work in Europe and other places where white people are located. There's Louise Kinshasa, who is a Congo-born African who is living in England, and who is the Secretary General of the African Socialist International, and whose work has taken him as an organizer of various places throughout Africa, and is very involved in organizing the African People's Socialist Party throughout Europe. And here we have online with us as well Vanessa Thompson, who is a German-born African, young German-born African woman. I keep saying young, and I'm sure you picked up on that by now. It's because I'm just so impressed with this comrade, who I think we're going to see increasingly becoming the face of the African Revolution. And I'm really proud to believe that the face of the African Revolution increasingly is going to be represented by women. And so she is an organizer, concentrating most of her work at this time in Germany. She lives in Frankfurt, is organizing. She's in Berlin right now doing the work to build the African Socialist International. We're going to come back in a moment, and then I'm going to open up this discussion to these comrades who are part of this panel. And so I thank you, and we're just going to have to take a brief music interlude, and then we'll get back into the meat of this discussion and take advantage of the things that these comrades will be bringing to us. Uhuru.
one go wash, no water you go use. To Bafesebe, O Milomalo.
Africa Live, this is Omali Shatela sitting in for Yambenga, Zimbabwe. We are discussing these unfolding events that clearly is shaking up everything for the U.S. and various other imperialist powers rapidly every day. This is a pre-recorded show, so you cannot call in. And we are recording this on Friday. You're listening to this by now on Sunday, and I'm sure that many events will have transpired between now and then that will make some of what we discussed today old news. But I think, again, that we're going to deal with the essential contradictions that will even give explanation to what will have transpired by the time you are hearing this. Again, we have with us Vanessa Thompson in Berlin, Germany, African-born woman in Berlin, Germany, Louise Kinshasa, Congo-born African in London, and Penny Hess, North American or white woman who is chairwoman of the African People's Socialist Party, African People's Solidarity Committee in the United States. So let's go into this discussion right away. We did just a brief overview of how things are unfolding, and here you are in the various locations with contacts and relationships and, of course, access to information beyond that. But let's take advantage of where it is that you are and what you're able to understand and perceive. How are these events being understood, articulated, experienced, say, in Germany, Vanessa?
Uhuru, comrades. Yes, these events, I mean, especially now, since the German embassy in Sudan, more explicit in Khartoum, is on fire, in a sort of way, the discussion around what do people or how do people in Germany perceive these events comes more directly on the plan. Now, it is pretty obvious that the German ruling class media criminalizes these protesters and psychologizes and pathologizes them as too sensitive. It might be that they are emphasizing the offensive nature of this film, but they lead, what's important here is also that the white left also, and even the African petty bourgeoisie, lead the discussion into a question of freedom of speech versus religious sensitivity. Now, this leads the whole discussion around these events away from the question if racism or if cultural racism, as it is named since some decades, is really the problem. Racism really the issue here. Now, the question that we have to raise, especially as African internationalists, is if the oppressed and colonized peoples would even rise up because of this film if they had power. Would they even care about this insult when they would have power over their resources, their land, their own lives? Would they demonstrate in such high numbers? I think the answer to this is no, because it becomes obvious here that racism is not the issue, that cultural racism is not the issue, that even this film is not the issue. But the ruling class media and political representatives wants to highlight this as the main issue. But we as African internationalists know that racism, which is an idea in people's head, would not affect the masses of the people in these countries if they had power, which means a film could not even be such an insult. So that's why we can conclude, at least as African internationalists, that these mass demonstrations are an articulation of the crisis of imperialism. Because we know that where there's oppression, there's resistance. So these mass demonstrations are the result of the ongoing attack on Africa and other oppressed nations, and not a reaction to a film someone has made.
Uhuru. Yeah. That, you know, what are you thinking about that, Luezi? What do you think?
Yes, this is a great show. It is big, you know, it's a very great honor to be on this show to listen to the overview the chairman gave, and just also listen to all my comrades. Vanessa said, you know, that's great. Basically, here in England, you can see there is an attempt, a deliberate attempt, to not to make what's happening the big news in the UK. So what they have done, first they came with an issue of topless Duchess of Cambridge, you know, the wife of the prince, the crown prince of England.
Kate.
So basically, they're trying to push that as the news. It's happening with the mass protest of the Muslim around the world. Because one thing it does definitely, it allows a lot of people here to say, but how can the U.S. ambassador be killed? Because this guy's supposed to be our guy. So this is some of the questions basically people have to deal with. How do you explain that the guys you put there, you know, have been, you know, have been able to kill the U.S. ambassador. And, of course, don't want that discussion really to be center stage, because this will be a recognition of failure. And the people here in this country have already a great sense of failure, in the sense that the government is seen as incompetent. Government is seen as a group of people with just a lot of money, have no correlation with the people, stuff like that. So all these really plays into that. And also, another thing is listen to the pundits and on radio and the people phoning in. You can see it's a lot of people phoning and showing sympathy with the protesters, because they're saying, why would you, you know, make those kind of films anyway? You know, when you already know what the action will be, and also it does not make the thing, it does not make the place better or any safer. So you have more people phoning to protest, as opposed to more people phoning to say that you unite with what the government's doing or what the government's saying. So I can see how the government feels like they need to take the heat off, you know, bring a different issue. And also in a place like Egypt, as the chairman talked about the balance of power shifting, as Gaddafi would have been the beneficiary of the change of regime in Egypt, you can see that the deal that's done in Egypt between Mohamed Morsi and the leader of the Brotherhood movement, or one of the leaders, and military, is shaky, because from what the press is saying, the Muslim Brotherhood are not in the control of the mass protests taking place right now in Egypt. All these demonstrators, you know, most of them have no allegiance to the Muslim Brotherhood. So what it does, it just deepens, you know, the process of resistance, of involvement, independent involvement of the masses, because we all want to see a socialist revolution. So we want people to move away from the bourgeoisie now. So this was a part of it. And in fact, even in Egypt, the masses are demanding the expulsion of the U.S. ambassador. You know, they get them killed, they're demanding the ambassador to be expelled. And this is, you know, is a significant demand, because we know all over the world, and particularly in Africa, people are trying to see or to learn from the struggles taking place all over the world. And this is also a demand we can learn from. Just imagine a situation where everyone in Africa, people are saying, get the U.S. out of Africa, you know, get the U.S. ambassador out of Africa. So it's really... the crisis is really, you know, significant. It's just powerful just to see all these protests that are in place. So it just exposed completely the British imperialism, the French imperialism, the U.S. imperialism. They brag about the voice of freedom of in the world. They bring they show people how to be how to drive diplomacy, how to solve problems. You know, using diplomacy and stuff like that. And you know, when you see places like Iran that have a conference of non-aligned countries that oppose the success, and the U.S. can't claim anything like that, the British can't claim anything like that, the French can't claim anything like that. They can't unite the people and have a genuine discussion on how you solve the problem in the world. You know, just war, 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 and aggression of other people's beliefs. So it's just really, really powerful just to see this protest and see the price. Unable to win the whole population to, you know, to explanation that will give a cover to the imperialism. So it's really, really powerful, you know, just to see the crisis unfolding. So, yeah, that's what I can say.
Comrade Luigi, it seems to me that it would be impossible for people to miss the fact that while the U.S. And most of Europe are crying crocodile tears about the sanctity of these embassies on the one hand, that the British briefly threatened to invade the embassy of Bolivia to capture Assange, who had taken refuge there, so that he wouldn't be sent. Where was it they were trying to send him to?
To Sweden.
They were trying to send him to
Sweden.
Yeah, they were trying to send him to Sweden because they charged him with rape or something like that. I mean, it's a clearly false charge, but because he had exposed what they were doing in places like those that are rising up today with that WikiLeaks, and he had taken refuge in the Bolivian embassy, and the British government had threatened to attack that embassy to bring him out of there. So it seems to me that that people won't be able to miss the hypocrisy of the crocodile tears they're crying now about the sanctity of these embassies when the British themselves had threatened to do the same thing until such an outcry emerged from various peoples around the world. But I think it was also important, Luigi, in terms of the overall crisis. You mentioned the non-aligned conference that just happened in Iran. And I'm not sure that most of our listeners saw that because the ruling class media did not do anything to help people know that that was happening except to protest the fact that Ban Ki-moon, who has, from his creation, as the head of the United Nations, has, you know, had the effrontery to attend that that conference. Can you just background that a little bit about that the non-aligned conference that happened in Iran?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Really appreciate your intervention. Just starting from Julian Assange, yeah, that's definitely it's a big hypocrisy, really massive. Hypocrisy that exposed the British government. That's really, yeah, that's true. For the non-aligned movement, I'm not sure which year it was created, but it was created during the Cold War by the countries newly independent from European colonialism, apart from Yugoslavia. The president of Yugoslavia was Tito. Mm-hmm. And he was a part of the founding, I can say, fathers of the movement. And you had Kwame Nkrumah, the first African to lead any African country on the continent to, you know, to freedom from direct colonialism. We had Nehru. Nehru was the leader of India. I think he took power after the death of Gandhi. We had Nasser, who used to be the leader of Egypt. Did I forget anything else? I think
those are some of the really important identifiable leaders of that movement.
Yeah. And what the they tried to do it basically in a world that was dominated by a contest between Soviet Union and the United States. They tried to develop a possibility that can basically express the voice or defend the interests of newly independent countries, other countries that didn't basically accept to be dominated by this contest. And it did offer people like Cuba, other countries, Ghana, a possibility to raise their concern to defend their independence, because they know when they went to places like UN, they can rely on power that was constituted by all those countries that were part of a non-aligned movement. That's a lot of countries. I think it was over 100 countries that were part of it. So it was a powerful movement. And this non-aligned movement basically started losing power or losing influence, I would say probably in the late 70s. And after the collapse of Soviet Union, it was seen as redundant. And I know at some point Cuba, under Fidel Castro, tried to bring it back, but it was not successful. And now we have seen Iran being able to bring it back to life. And this event that took place in Tehran, as the chairman said, was attended by the UN leader, Kim Ban-moon, and the imperialist press boycotted it. It was not given any coverage, really. Serious coverage in England or France or Belgium, I'm not sure about the US, but they did not report anything that happened there. And this definitely allowed Iran and I'm sure other countries were about of it, basically, to break the isolation the U.S. and the European countries have been trying to impose on Iran. And it's also part of the shift of power that's happening in the world, because I'm not sure how this non-aligned movement will develop. But from our perspective, anyway, African internationalism, we're not saying this is a substitute for a new international that needs to be built. But definitely is a
perfect right. Yes, Roto. It seems to me that the events that we're seeing, you know, that it's, some things are really outstanding now in terms of the crisis of imperialism. But I think the events that we're seeing with the uprisings around these embassies and targeting various symbols of U.S. And imperialist power, the emergence of the non-aligned, re-emergence of the non-aligned nations to break the encirclement and isolation that the U.S. and other imperialist powers would impose on anyone that's trying to go in a way that's independent of desperate imperialism at this moment. I think this is clearly a demonstration of the fact that of the weakening of white power, the growing loss of influence of imperialist white power. But I would remind us that that this crisis, I believe, you know, became obvious to some of us as early as August and September, August of 2001, when, as a consequence of a lot of work that had been done, especially by Africans and others at that Durban United Nations conference that happened in many ways against the will of the leaders of the United Nations, the conference on racism, xenophobia, and other kinds of contradictions that resulted in a declaration that Africans, the slavery and colonialism constituted crimes against humanity, that Africans were due reparations, and that characterized Israel as an apartheid-type regime, et cetera. And that, I think, was the something that really took the whole white power imperialists aback. Even the U.S. Would not even allow full diplomatic representation at that meeting. Israel boycotted, the U.S. boycotted. I think Canada may have boycotted it. But that was, I think, a real turning point in many ways, could have exposed it, because that got at the essential question about the parasitic relationship that Europe has to the rest of us. Then, of course, that conference was over. Africans went back to different locations, elated about what the outcome of that was. And then within days, 9/11 happened. And, of course, 9/11, I think, was another example of the crisis of imperialism. I know I say this despite the fact that there are many who have come up with the conspiracy assumption that the U.S. did it to itself in order to justify attacking everybody else, and which obviously is a possibility because we can't put anything above the imperialists. But I think that one reason people would say that is because they assume that the U.S. is this all-powerful entity, and I think a lot of white people in this country would rather think the U.S. did it to itself than the fact that there are masses of non-white people all around the world lurking in dark places and having meetings about how to overturn this relationship we have with imperialism. But either way, if it were truly done by Arab or Muslims, or if it were done by the United States to itself, it still represents a crisis of imperialism, a crisis that the U.S. would have to go to such a length to try to justify smashing struggle or crushing movements of resistance around the world. I think that either way, it is clear that they had a serious problem. I think that that's really important, this mention of the non-aligned nations. And Penny Hess has just been sitting here, really eager to get involved in this discussion and to bring some insights that she would share, you know, with us. So, Penny, you know, go ahead.
Uhuru. Uhuru, Chairman, and uhuru to Secretary General Luwazi and to Vanessa. I just want to say it's such an honor to be able to participate in this brilliant discussion. And, Chairman, your overview was outstanding and very exciting. And, you know, I just was thinking about the fact that you were talking about the crisis of imperialism, but if you go all the way back to your writings, to your political report, to the First Party Congress in 1981, you're describing and talking about the crisis of imperialism at that time. And in fact, you wrote about the specifics of much of the world, and if you look at that, it's the same players, the same contradictions, just a deepened crisis today. So African internationalism has